Okay, now it's time for our fourth Friday Focus with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And we have on the line, we have Daniel Hauser, who has a master's degree in public policy from Oregon State University. And there in his graduate work, he studied student loan repayment schemes, published in the Higher Education Policy Journal. He has also been a Hatfield resident at Portland State University, where he studied agriculture policy. Daniel also has worked as a transportation policy analyst for the Association of Oregon Counties, and now working with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, tax specialist, and other policy issues. Daniel Hauser, are you here, and can you hear me?
I am, Mark. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, great. Hey, looks like you're coming in pretty good. And what other things do you work there at the Oregon Center for Public Policy besides tax policy? What are some of your other specialties?
Yeah, I also do our work on the minimum wage. We were happy to be supportive of the last minimum wage increase just a little over a year ago. And that has resulted in hundreds of thousands of Oregonians seeing the wages they take home increase. So that is one of the areas. One of our more current areas that I'm working on is our work on affordable housing and figuring out ways to help infuse resources into helping low-income and middle-income people find a way to afford their rent, as well as making sure that we're not spending resources giving tax benefits or other giveaways to the wealthiest Oregonians who don't need that help affording a home.
Sure. Well, actually, that kind of is a backdoor lead-in to the topic of the day, and that is the conference committee's tax plan has been sent out on the federal level to, I guess they're still doing some votes, but it looks like it's going to be on the president's desk soon. And I should start with just what are your general impressions of this bill? I'm assuming that you've studied the best you can with the limited time, the conference committee markups. And tell us a little bit about this, and then maybe we can have some questions.
I think the simplest way to think of it is tax cuts that are really focused on businesses and the richest Oregonians and Americans, not on the employees and the middle class. And it ends up driving a deficit over the next decade that estimates range from $1 to over $2 trillion that will be used as a rationale by the Senate majorities to cut a lot of services and programs Oregonians depend on. And so I'm more than happy to go into a lot of the specifics of the bill and would love it if you had some particular pieces of it you'd like me to delve into deeper.
Sure. Well, one thing I don't hear a lot of discussion about, and maybe you could lend some insight to, is there any, I've studied economics, and so it's not making a whole lot of sense to me in this bill. So no one is talking about, in my mind, why wealthy people and corporations need such tax relief as, stock market is high as it's ever been. Corporate profits seem to be high. One thing that isn't happening for the middle class, or there doesn't seem to be wages, don't seem to be increasing. And so with high profitability and income distribution is as divergent from the wealthy and the rest of us that in my lifetime that I can remember. So what is the economic rationale, if there is any, for doing this bill at this time?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Mark. The wages for most workers and most Americans in general have been really stagnant over the last couple decades. Only in the last year or so have we really started seeing wages increase nationally. Oregon's been a little bit ahead of that curve, but still the wage growth, given how low our unemployment rates are and how profitable corporations and other businesses are, is still kind of befuddling for a lot of us who study these things closely and trying to grapple with how this particular tax provision will actually help the wages of the middle class is in many ways a fool's errand, because it won't. At a base level, this is not a bill that's going to help people's wages. I know that the Trump administration had put forward some rationale that basically just said, trust us, the average worker will get thousands more in wages because we're sending corporations all of this extra money. So just trust us, this is the case. But any real empirical or independent analysis has not found that to be true, has not found any link between corporate tax cuts and wage growth. And as you pointed out, right now the economy is actually doing fairly well. We're at a mature stage in this recovery from the recession. We've been recovering for a number of years now. And infusing right now, when it looks like inflation is starting to pick up, when it looks like a lot of the indicators are doing really well for corporations in terms of the amount of cash they're sitting on, it really doesn't make much sense from an economic standpoint. And there have been some analysts who have argued that one of the results of this bill will be to provide additional stimulus or additional sort of activity in the corporate sector that could actually lead us even closer to a recession and could continue increasing the need for interest rates to increase. And so one of the results of this might actually be that we see inflation, the cost of goods, rising more rapidly, which will impact the quality of life of a lot of middle-income Oregonians who aren't going to see the wage increases, as well as interest rates for folks that are looking to buy a home or take out other debt.
Now, some economists in the past have said that corporations particularly, and to some extent consumers, have been benefiting tremendously from a very long period of somewhat low, and some say artificially held low, interest rates, and that some rise in interest rates could actually be good for the economy. However, that's unclear to me. So do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that interest rates should be rising at least a little bit in the medium term, although probably not immediately, is that because one of the Federal Reserve's most helpful tools it can use when we do start seeing a recession, start seeing growth really slow for our economy, is to cut interest rates, to provide some short-term stimulation to the investment decisions that both individuals and businesses make, to really incentivize people to go ahead and make large purchases, invest in new equipment, and things of that nature. And so when the Federal Reserve's interest rates that then trickle through the economy to the interest rates people pay on their debts and otherwise, when that's really low, it doesn't give them any, it gives them one less tool that they can use when a recession does happen again. And if there's one of the things that we do know is that a recession will happen again, we will have another recession. It's just a question of when. And when the economy is doing well, there is a lot of reason to think that very modest increases and very measured and predictable increases in the interest rates can actually have positive effects more broadly too. One of the challenges, though, is that if the interest rates are rising simply as a result of the economy being strong, but that none of that income is actually being passed through to employees and to most Americans, that they're not really seeing some of the benefits of why the economy is growing. And the interest rates can kind of end up being a double whammy for the average family.
Well, I suppose it just depends if you're, and one of the things that, and certainly in American consumer world, debt is probably higher than optimal from most economists' point of view in the average household, and savings are at a minimum. So interest rates would hurt people who are high in debt and low in savings.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we would believe, or we would argue, that it would be positive to find some ways of incentivizing greater saving. But the reality is people don't have enough income to afford the basics and the necessities they
exactly.
need to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a cruel joke in many ways to tell people in the lower and middle classes that they need to save more and take on less debt when they can't afford rent.
So here we're providing a small tax cut to most people for a limited amount of time, and a large tax cut for the wealthy folks. Now, I'm confused about this one thing, and this whole wage idea. And my back of the envelope calculation suggests to me that when you have inflation, prices rise, and in economic theory, wages are just one more price in the grander economy. And yet, going all the way back to the economic growth of the, say, the 90s and the Bill Clinton era and other eras since basically Reagan, wages don't seem to act like other prices. So when we've had higher inflation times, wages have not gone up, and we've had, so it's to me, I'm suggesting that wages are not in a free market situation at this time. And with the loss of unions, loss of bargaining power, and the inability to affect wages, and we have now unemployment that's at 4%, perhaps threatening to go below 4%, and yet still there's no upward rise or pressure on wages. What about that issue of wages actually being separated from the economy and actually not in a relatively free market, as most economists would like to say?
Yeah, I think a lot of the economic models assume that there's really easy movement between positions and really easy access for workers to find higher wages and to find greater opportunities in the economy when unemployment's low. You know, it argues that folks should be able to find better jobs. And one of the realities is that anyone who's tried to find a new job knows is there's a lot of cost to changing jobs. If you have to move, if you have to, you know, be retrained, if you have to actually go through the effort of locating those positions and effectively taking those jobs. So one of the realities is that in Oregon, at least, that the connection between economic growth and wage growth has not been very strong. We have, like I mentioned earlier, seen some wage growth and some that often is better than the national trends, but it still isn't what we would expect and what we would hope to see. Oregon right now in many ways has seen its unemployment rate not dropping any further. So the Oregon unemployment rate recently reached record lows in the last year. But it's kind of stagnated there because businesses are unable to actually find the right employees for the right jobs that they're looking for. And so job openings are actually at fairly high levels as well, as we're seeing this unemployment very low. So what that means is the economic theory is you would then see wage growth really pick up and really drive more people out from the wings who aren't in the labor force and really start looking for jobs, and you would see more people filtering up into higher paying and higher quality jobs. And that's something we really haven't seen at the level you would expect. And unfortunately, the tax bill has passed. It seems like it won't do anything to help that process along. In many ways, what we expect is that it'll just perpetuate this situation where we see business owners and we see corporations more broadly taking in record profits without seeing the wage growth that we would really like to see.
And it also seems to me that corporations, if they get a big pot of money, it seems almost that they're legally obligated to send it to their shareholders as opposed to just go ahead and spend money. If they have business, they'll hire labor to satisfy those orders. But if they just get a chunk of money, I don't see any incentive to hire anyone unless you actually have an increase in demand.
Yeah, there's some really interesting pieces of that, too. I mean, if you have a goal of providing the same level of products or services, and you want to, over the long run, improve your profitability, you might invest in technologies that actually will reduce the amount of labor that you need.
Yes.
And so one of the interesting things is if you have a ton of cash and nowhere to put it, you might find some innovative ways to increase productivity, but that productivity growth at the same level of outputs will result in fewer inputs, right? So less people will actually be doing those services, and more, say, in manufacturing, it might be machines or whatever the example might be. And one of the things that I think is also really interesting in thinking about this is that when corporations have been polled and broader large businesses have been asked what they would do with these revenues, these unexpected extra cash that they'll be seeing over the next decade and further, is that they plan on using it to buy back some shares, to provide larger dividends, like you suggested, to their shareholders, not necessarily to hire more people and hire more employees. It's a stark reality over recent history that when corporate profits have been high, it hasn't necessarily correlated or been connected to larger levels of hiring.
Now, just to touch back on something we touched on earlier, but just to kind of hammer it home, with unemployment under 4%, record stock market, corporations having record profits, and now a big tax cut, I'm not hearing economists say that we're in a big danger for, you know, an inflationary period like we had in the 70s. Now, why would that not be true, and why aren't people talking about that?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, I do know that the expectations for the inflation to tick up at least modestly are there. The Federal Reserve has indicated they expect to raise rates a few times next year, and that they think that the inflation rate will be coming much closer, if not surpassing their goal of 2%. However, because of the way wage growth and also, you know, energy prices and other inputs into the inflation figures are behaving, it doesn't look like there will be any kind of widespread and really substantial inflationary pressures beyond just reaching a more of a normal long-term level. So it's certainly not something that most people are too worried about. And from what I understand, people think that it'll be fairly modest and will not end up causing any kind of, you know, widespread inflation like, you know, was happening in the 70s.
And then there are other critics of the bill who say it would actually cause a recession. And can you explain the mechanism how this tax bill could cause a recession?
Yeah, I think often recessions happen when the economy overheats and when the economy reaches a point where it will, where simply put, that it's overperforming what it will be in the long term and is not really behaving the way that a lot of the models would expect. And so if this infuses even more funds into corporations when they already have a surplus of cash, I mean, I don't know that it will, that we can say with any confidence that it will cause a recession or anything like that. But I do think that it isn't necessarily what we need and what the economy needs right now. Guessing recessions is often a very unsuccessful effort. The economy behaves in interesting ways, and so I don't think that it's likely, and I haven't heard really clear arguments that this is going to cause a recession, but this is absolutely not the time to be passing these types of policies. What we need is wage growth. What we need is the average Oregonian seeing more income, and this isn't going to help that.
It seems with the current way the labor market has been running that the only way, in my mind, that lower wage earners will get a wage increase is if it's legislated, because the market doesn't seem to be doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, that in many ways the market is not naturally bringing wages up as quickly as we would like.
Now, a lot of talk on this, the buzz on this is that the tax breaks for the wealthy and for corporations are permanent, and yet the smaller tax breaks for the average working person and say the lower 60% of the income scale are temporary and are going to go away. And not only that, but the tax cuts for lower income people at max out around 2%, and yet for the top 5%, those tax cuts go way up over 4%. So they're not only getting more because they earn more, but they're getting a higher percentage of their, taxes, cut. And there's kind of a couple sneaky technical things when these individual tax cuts go away. They'll actually raise taxes for those folks. And it has to, can you explain some of that? Because you think, well, maybe it'll just go back to where it was in 2017. But no, their taxes are actually going to go up. And can you explain how that's going to happen?
Certainly. So one of the things that is, I think, one of those sneaky technical pieces that you mentioned is they're going to change how a lot of the tax provisions inflate over time. It seems that inflation has become a theme of this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But how the tax code controls for inflation is by adjusting the brackets and adjusting various pieces of the standard deduction, various things like that, by a rate of inflation. And so the current system uses just the consumer price index. And under this bill, moving forward, things will be inflated by a different inflation measure called the chained consumer price index. So very wonky here, but what the end result is that over time, a lot of the provisions that will help working Oregonians will actually grow at a slower rate than they would previously. And so what that means is that in 2027, when this bill has been fully implemented and a lot of the personal income tax pieces of it have expired, that the bottom 60% of Oregonians should average about a $60 tax increase. And so what we see is that over 500,000 Oregonians in 2027 will have a tax increase by this bill. And so it's really something where, like you said, the corporate and the business, mainly the corporate income tax cuts in this bill will actually be in place permanently. And the tax cuts that are framed as the reason for this bill is giving money to the middle class, all of that rhetoric really isn't aligned with what this bill is actually designed to do, because those tax cuts are going to expire at the end of 2025. Yet the pieces that are going most to the rich, and particularly corporations, will stay in place permanently. And so we see, for example, in 2019, the bottom 60% of Oregonians will get a $430 on average tax cut. And like I said, that then swaps over to a tax increase by 2027. But for the top 1%, they will immediately see in 2019 a tax cut on average in Oregon of almost $34,000, which is a really shocking scale of a giveaway at a time when we really desperately need funding for education and other services. And that will actually shrink a little bit by 2027 because a lot of the benefits they do receive are from the personal income tax cut side too. But they'll still be getting, at the same year that the bottom 60% of Oregonians are getting a tax hike, they'll still be saving on average over $5,000 on their taxes. And so it really is either today or when a lot of the pieces expire, a bill that will help the richest Oregonians, not the rest.
Now, of course, there's two arguments that are being made to counter what you just said. And one of them is, I think I heard Mitch McConnell say that, well, since we decided to do this through reconciliation, we had to cut those benefits. And in future years, we're going to reinstate those tax cuts for the average person. That was one argument that was made. And then, this is the other argument. The other argument is that the deficits that are being projected won't actually materialize because the economic activity stimulated will increase all tax revenues to cover it. And is there any empirical evidence to suggest that that would happen?
On your first question about these claims that the tax breaks for personal income taxpayers, for working folks, will not actually expire, the only evidence and the only thing we have to work on is the language in the bill. If they wanted to prioritize working Oregonians, then they wouldn't have made these temporary. What they made permanent was the corporate tax cuts, not those for working Oregonians. And so the only thing we can take them on is their actions. And they acted today or earlier this week to move forward passing a bill that will, in effect, be a transfer of wealth over the long term from workers to corporations. And so I think these claims that the Senate leadership have been making that, well, down the road in 2025 or 2026, we will renew and extend these tax breaks because no one would want to raise taxes on these groups is really interesting, because then it conflates with that question of how big the deficit is for this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reason that they made them temporary was so that they could keep the deficit increase to only $1.5 trillion.
Exactly.
So if these tax cuts do get renewed, which many of them, do have positive benefits to working Oregonians, but if they're renewed, then that deficit hole just continues to blow up bigger and bigger. And let's keep in mind, this is at a time when a lot of baby boomers are going to be joining the Social Security and Medicare rolls, and will be driving up public costs because of that. So we already project that our deficit's going to be increasing before this bill was passed. And if we assume that this bill is signed by the president, and we assume that they do renew those personal income tax cuts in the 2020s, the deficit is really starting to reach worrying numbers. And as a share of our economy, it's surpassing levels that we've never seen before, at least since World War II. But I think to your second point about the deficit for this bill actually not being as bad as all of the nonpartisan and all of the independent economists have found, and their analyses is also really interesting, because nowhere have we seen evidence that's truly compelling and truly rigorous that would argue that these tax cuts are going to increase growth anywhere near the level of the deficit increases they're projecting. I mean, the most conservative estimate I saw would have put the deficit growth still in the hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 10 years. And that's assuming really generous growth levels that I don't think the vast majority of folks are assuming. I mean, a lot of these are putting the number, even assuming growth, you know, and being generous, at least $1 trillion in a deficit increase over the next decade.
I mean, I'm hearing some people talk about, you know, growth between 3 to 6% annually, and that's just seems. I mean, I don't know how they could possibly calculate that. I mean, it just sounds outrageous to me, and I don't know what to think about it.
Yeah, I would think about it as outrageous, like you said. It's a claim you make when you don't have to be held accountable to the facts.
Wow. Is there anything in this tax bill that you like?
Well, I think that's what becomes challenging about this broader conversation, is that there are some small provisions in this bill that if they were on their own and in isolation, not combined with all of the terrible pieces of this bill, we at the Oregon Center for Public Policy could support. I mean, the standard deduction rising to not quite double of what it is currently is good. That is a policy benefit or a policy change that will benefit working families. The vast majority of taxpayers today that are in the working class don't itemize their deductions. And so this is going to be a tax benefit for them. The problem, however, is that it's a small benefit when compared to the enormous benefits that are being handed out to the rich and businesses. And then these same Oregonians that are getting the small benefit will see significant decreases in the services that they're going to be receiving over the next decade as the Republican majorities use the deficit as a rationale to cut services.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it was only, you know, just a bill that was on its own going to double the standard deduction, that would be something that would be a positive change. Another example is the mortgage interest deduction.
Mm-hmm.
They proposed in the Senate bill, they would have reduced the mortgage interest deduction only to mortgages that are $500,000 or less. At the end of the day, in their negotiations, they ended up changing it to $750,000 or less.
Mm-hmm.
And we think there's really no excuse to be giving someone a break on their taxes who chose to buy an $800,000 home at a time when we have desperate affordable housing needs.
Sure.
That said, they should have brought it down much further. We're still going to be subsidizing the interest on a $750,000 mortgage, and that can even be someone's second home. So it's an improvement. It's a policy change that will make our tax code a little bit more progressive, but a little bit more progressive at the same time as you're cutting, for example, the top tax rate by over 2%. And allowing it to apply to only a higher threshold of income really means that for high-income, you know, Oregonians or Americans who are able to buy a $750,000 home, they're really not losing much.
Mm-hmm.
They're still making out like a bandit in this bill.
Sure. And I would suppose that the projected increases in health insurance premiums alone could wipe out most of the middle-class tax breaks just on its own.
Yeah, that's another really interesting part of this, is that because they went ahead and included the elimination of the requirement in the tax code for folks to buy health insurance, millions of Oregonians, what's going to end up happening is that a lot of working class and a lot of folks that are really near the average income level are going to see their insurance no longer be affordable that they would like to purchase. And even more worrisome over the longer term is that as folks who aren't required to buy insurance choose not to buy insurance because they're healthy at that point in their life,
mm-hmm.
it'll actually make it to where the folks who are insured are sicker. And what happens when we reach that kind of continual degradation, the continual shrinking of who's being insured, who's healthy, it drives up costs for everyone who's still in that insurance pool. And so we really expect that because of their repeal of the individual mandate in the tax code to have health insurance, that we will see premiums rise more quickly than they otherwise would have, which kind of ends up in this, you know, worrisome spiral where it then makes insurance more expensive and then prompts more people to choose to go uninsured,
leaving
only the sickest in the insurance pools and further driving up costs. So it's a sneaky way of getting around the fact that they failed to repeal the Affordable Care Act earlier this year and are now just trying to undermine our health insurance markets any way they can. And one provision that I did want to make sure to mention that I think is in all of this is kind of easy to get lost is that the estate tax, the amount of an individual's estate when they pass away that does not need to be taxed is being doubled in this bill. And so for a married couple, when their estate goes on to their surviving children or whoever they're leaving their estate to, currently it's about $11 million that they would have exempt from any taxation. And under this bill, they actually double that to $22 million. And so what we estimate is that in Oregon alone, that'll save the richest 1% of Oregonians around $47 million in 2019. So in 1 year, this one provision that really has received little attention is going to save tens of millions of dollars from the richest Oregonians. And that's just one little piece of this bill that has no lack of problems.
Yeah. I suppose one other little piece I thought that was thrown in at the end that sounds really, really questionable to me is the pass-through tax cut. I guess they called it the Corker Amendment, even though he claimed no knowledge of it. And that seems to really benefit very wealthy people who deal in businesses that don't hire people.
Yeah, it's an interesting
like real
provision.
Estate.
I mean... Yeah, no, absolutely. And one of the things that's really fascinating about that provision is that a lot of people think of pass-through businesses, which are partnerships, LLCs, S-corporations, think of them as Main Street small businesses, when in reality the vast majority of the income from pass-through businesses goes to the richest Oregonians. And the particular provision in this bill that they passed was actually to provide a reduction in the taxes that pass-through businesses will end up paying. And so they actually are able to deduct 20% up to a certain income level from their taxes. And what this will end up doing is really driving down the taxes that these pass-through businesses, again, that are, you know, what they're passing through is the profits on a business to their owners. And those owners, generally speaking, are some of the highest income individuals. The Corker provision that you mentioned is that they actually have this threshold where if you're over a certain income level, you don't get the full benefit of this pass-through break. And they added this part in where you can actually use parts, like a share of the property that's owned by the business to kind of increase the level at which you can take the break. And so one of the most prominent businesses that has really significant property ownership happen to be developers and happen to be real estate corporations, of which Senator Corker happens to be a big player and was prior to his becoming a senator. And so it's one of those where Corker has been actively attempting to distance himself from it, but he was the only Republican who voted against this bill. And miraculously, when this provision was added, you know, it could have very well been a coincidence that he then also chose to support this bill.
Interesting. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there anything that I didn't bring up or you didn't bring up that you'd like to make sure that people know about what's going on here?
Yeah, I think one provision that was discussed pretty heavily during the debates on these bills, but hasn't maybe received as much attention right at the end here, is the state and local tax deduction. One in three Oregonians currently use this deduction, which is more than all but in just a handful of other states. And for Oregonians who use it, they save over $12,000 on their taxes on average. And these are the property taxes and state income taxes, generally in Oregon, that people are then able to deduct from their federal taxes. They capped this in the final bill at $10,000 combined between state and state income and property taxes. And so what that means for one in three Oregonians, that on average that they'll be losing a couple thousand dollars on their itemized deductions as a result of that cap.
Oh, okay. So then their deductions total $12,000, not the resulting reduction of their taxes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
that's
gotcha.
Important to keep in mind.
Yeah.
As this is a tax deduction,
okay.
What that means is it reduces the taxable income that the tax rates are then applied to.
Gotcha.
Excuse me, that are then applied to. Which will result in the actual tax owed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a tax credit, which would directly apply to the taxes owed.
So there's a lot of sort of average income Oregonians that have those types of deductions that get over $10,000, up to $12,000 on average, you say?
Yeah, one of the reasons that's the case in Oregon is because we don't have a sales tax.
And
so the income tax is used very heavily to lean on how we fund our services.
Mm-hmm.
And so this isn't something that, you know, there's not a lot of folks that are making 40 grand that are getting 10 grand in SALT deduction. This is one that does tilt more towards the middle upper income Oregonians, but it is one that will still hit a lot of middle class Oregonians and reduce their ability to deduct these taxes they're paying to other government agencies. And honestly, I think to kind of summarize where this bill falls across the board is that it's really a tax cut for the rich. More of the benefits of this bill go to the top 1% than go to the bottom 60%.
Hmm.
It's tax cuts for businesses, pass-through businesses, like you mentioned, but even more so to the big corporations, not to the workers. And finally, it does end up blowing, somewhere in the ballpark of $1 to $2 trillion hole in the deficit that will be used as a rationale to cut the services Oregonians depend on.
Yeah, and a lot of those services go to lower and middle income people whose temporary tax breaks will be eroded before they get cut.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Daniel Hauser, thank you so much. We could go on about this for a long time. I really appreciate your time, your energy into doing the research. And if folks want to read more about this, tell them where they can go.
Yeah, I really encourage your listeners to come visit us at www.ocpp.org. That's where we post all of our analyses on these on this tax bill, as well as state-specific tax provisions and the budgetary implications of these bills. It's where folks can sign up for our newsletter so they can receive these announcements immediately when we release new research on what the impacts are going to be to Oregonians from various tax proposals. And we really hope that they feel that all of your listeners and all Oregonians in general feel empowered to reach out to us with questions. All of our contact information is on there. And I'm more than happy to work through what a lot of these complex tax bills really mean for people.
Thank you, Daniel. You're really, really excellent in explaining complicated issues in a way people can understand. And it's I greatly appreciate your contribution to the show.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's always a pleasure to be on.
Okay. And we'll talk to you or another of your compatriots next month on the Fourth Friday Focus. And have a great Christmas.
Thanks. Happy holidays.
Okay. Bye.